This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Public universities have historically provided students from low-income backgrounds an opportunity to afford a higher education. Marion Wang, an education reporter for ProPublica, has found that public universities are allocating less in aid to the neediest students and more to wealthier students. What is behind this trend? What does it mean for low-income students who both desperately need help in paying for school and increasingly need a college degree to succeed? We'd like you to join the conversation today. Did you or your student get financial aid help? Did you have to take out loans? What's it like to try and pay for school today in an environment where dollars are tight? You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. In just a moment, we'll be joined by Jeff Bartlett, who's a college specialist at Hartford Public High School, to talk about what he sees on a daily basis, students trying to pay for school. But first, we're going to welcome in Marion Wang, who is an education reporter for ProPublica. She's reported extensively on higher education in the U.S., and she's written this story that we've been fascinated by: public universities ramp up aid for the wealthy, leaving the poor behind. Marion, welcome to Where We Live.
Great to be here.
So first of all, before we get into some of your specific findings, let's break down the different ways in which students actually get financial assistance to pay for college. I mean, there's grants and there's loans. Give us a little rundown here of what students usually get if they need some help.
Yeah, so usually the first step when you know you're going to have any sort of financial need is to fill out the FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid. It is, you know, a federal application, and then that sort of looks at your finances. You input a ton of information, and it spits out, essentially, according to the federal formula, basically a breakdown of, you know, if you qualify, the federal Pell Grant, which is a pot of free money that you won't have to pay back. That's a grant. You know, scholarships are the same. You don't have to pay those back. And it'll separate out loans, you know, which is something that you do have to pay back. So there are federal student loans that you can get. There are private student loans that you can get. And then there are also federal grants, like the Pell Grant, as well as private grants that you can go out and apply for, or aid that you can get from the university. So there are three different sources, essentially. You have the government grants, both federal and state, depending on your state. You have private grants from outside of any sort of university system. And then many universities offer aid on their own. Those are institutional grants.
So as we go down this list and we talk about some of the things that have changed over the years, one thing I guess I just want to get out of the way up front. I mean, we hear from the Obama administration not so long ago. Education Secretary Arne Duncan was in our town, Hartford, answering questions from students and reporters. And he basically said, you know, if you want to go to college in America today, you can. There's something out there to help you pay for the enormous costs. Is that right? I mean, if you really want to go to school, are the financial aid and financial loan possibilities out there for you to go?
You know, there are grants, there are loans. It depends in large part on your family's financial situation. I mean, a very low income family may qualify for that student may qualify for a Pell Grant, but then are they willing to take on, you know, $30,000 in loans if they don't get any aid from the university? That's a pretty big commitment for a low-income family that has probably tried its best to stay out of debt.
We're talking today with Marion Wang, who's education reporter for ProPublica, who's reported extensively on higher education in the U.S. and the cost of higher education, which is what we're talking about today. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266, we'd love to hear your stories about paying for an expensive college education, whether you're a student on break right now or you're a parent helping your student pay for school. 860-275-7266. We'd especially love to hear your tales about trying to get money at a public university to go to school. So this story that you wrote about public universities and how they're divvying up the aid really got us fascinated and got us thinking about this. You tell the story of Shaniqua Epps. Maybe you can start us by telling her story and what she tells us about this overall trend that you've been reporting on.
So Shaniqua was an interesting case for me. You know, when I first met her, you know, everything sounded like she was going to be a great qualifier for aid. She, you know, was close to the top of her class. She had, you know, she graduated with a 3.8 GPA. She was really involved in sports in her high school, you know, secretary, then president of her student government. She was just very involved, and everyone I talked to about her said, you know, her high school counselor said she really stood out in terms of trying to chart a different path for herself, different than her siblings, different than the other kids in her school, different than her peer group, her immediate closest friends at school. And, you know, she applied to a number of colleges, including, and she was accepted to a number of them, including the three state schools in Pennsylvania, her home state. But she didn't get a single dollar of aid from any of them. And in the enrollment management, that's this industry now that schools often employ consultants from. They often have their own enrollment managers. In that industry's parlance, we call that an admit-deny, where you admit a student, but you give them so little aid that essentially it's a denial because you know their family circumstances.
So she essentially got admit-denied, which is a term that sounds fairly unfortunate. And this happened because she just didn't have the sort of profile that the state schools in Pennsylvania wanted?
Well, so there are many reasons that this is happening to low-income students. And one of them is that states have dramatically cut back the support that they have historically had for higher education. And so in the last 5 years, state colleges at Pennsylvania have seen really dramatic rollbacks in their funding from the state. And so that definitely puts a squeeze on what they can give out to students. But also, increasingly we're seeing institutions adopt a sort of thinking about financial aid that is less altruistic than it used to be and much more utilitarian. And so increasingly schools are doing what's called financial aid leveraging. They want to leverage their financial aid dollars to get the maximum impact and maximum benefit for the school. So if I'll just say that again, they want the maximum impact and benefit for the school. It's no longer just about can we help a student that needs it get to college and be able to attend college who might otherwise not have been in the past a student that would have attended our college. It's much more these days about how can we make our ends meet, how can we, you know, help our bottom line. And students like Shaniqua are not going to be that student that actually helps your bottom line. But if you divvied up what you might have to give a student like Shaniqua and gave it instead in, you know, $5,000 increments to students who maybe don't need it less but would come with a scholarship and maybe are comparison shopping between a private college and a state college, then you get the most bang for your buck.
You get the most bang for your buck because why? And let's just explain this as plainly as possible. What you're essentially saying is that long-term, Shaniqua Epps, someone who is lower income, who traditionally might get state aid to go to a state school, isn't going to be giving big money to the school once she gets out of school. She's going to cost the school more money along the way. What exactly do we mean here?
Yeah, so I think that's part of it. A lot of schools who are pretty sophisticated in terms of understanding who their donors are may do that analysis. I don't know for sure that the schools that didn't give her aid were doing that particular analysis, but I just mean bang for your buck in the most immediate sense, that if you give a pretty middle-class, well-to-do student a $5,000 discount, for instance, off your sticker price, they're still bringing, if your tuition is, you know, $40,000, or, you know, $30,000, they're still bringing, you know, $25,000 to your school. Shaniqua may take a larger scholarship and may need a larger scholarship in order to make it possible for her to attend that school. And a lot of these state schools are looking at that and are saying, you know, why not split that aid up and incentivize three well-to-do students to attend our school.
So it's essentially a pot sweetener for some better-off students to go to a school that's probably a pretty good state school, might be competitive academically and in prestige with some of the private schools they're applying to. So it helps to get, in their mind, a class of students that gives them a better bang for the buck. As you report, Marion, this seems to be somewhat at odds with the role of the state university systems around the country at least traditionally speaking. What are you hearing from schools that you talk to about this trend? Because if you look right now on Twitter at Where We Live, you know, we're actually tweeting out your story right now so that people can read along. There's a very handy chart, as you see, the dollars declining for needier students and the dollars increasing for less needy students. What are schools saying about all this?
You know, a lot of the financial aid administrators I talk to, even college presidents I've spoken with, say that this is just kind of an unfortunate reality. They tend to point to the lack of state support and the cutback in state support as the reason why this is happening. Some, in more candid moments, will tell you that, you know, I talked to a president of a state school that said we sort of had a country club atmosphere and we wanted to do that, and we built out our university. We did a lot of construction. I sort of have regrets about that, but it was all, he said, part of the prestige race and trying to compete for those top students.
A last question for you, Marion. Is there any sort of government oversight of this? Because clearly the state schools, while getting less money in some places than they have traditionally in the past because of difficult economic circumstances in those states, they still have a mission, and the mission's a little bit different state by state, but clearly they do have a mission to educate the people of that state, people of all backgrounds. I guess I'm wondering if there's any sort of a governmental oversight, if any state legislatures or the federal government is taking a closer look at this trend that you're reporting on.
So that's a really great question. After our story, some of the state schools in Pennsylvania had taken a look at this. There was a hearing called. They're sort of examining and studying the issue right now. But it really depends on your state. Some states tend to have some rules about, the percentage of in-state students you can have versus out-of-state students. Out-of-state students clearly bring in more dollars. And so it really depends on your state, but and how fast that particular institution and the lawmakers there hold to this ideal of having state universities be this really important pathway to greater success for these students.
And what is happening to the students who can't get into the schools they want because they can't get the financial aid, schools that they are absolutely qualified to get into, but schools that they just can't, for whatever reason, afford to get in? Where are they going instead?
Well, so increasingly we're hearing from college access counselors that work with these type of students that you know, they're seeing a lot more students who got accepted to state schools and, you know, aren't able to afford to get in there. And aren't actually able to afford it, and so they don't attend, and they end up going to community college and hoping that in 2 years they'll be able to transfer. The statistics on that population, though, who get through community college and actually are able to transfer are very low. You know, the community college that Shaniqua Epps ended up at had an 8% graduation rate, and so the chances are not good when you put a student who can do much more in an environment where, you know, maybe the peer effects are, you know, and most of their peers are not succeeding. It just doesn't, it's not a motivator, and it often hinders their chances of eventually actually getting that four-year degree.
Marion Wang is an education reporter for ProPublica. She's reported on higher education in the U.S., including this story, Public Universities Ramp Up Aid for the Wealthy, Leaving the Poor Behind. You can find out more on our website, WNPR.org, including the charts that show some of these trends. Marion, thank you very much for your reporting and for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much.
When we come back from our break, we'll be joined by Jeff Bartlett. He's a college specialist at Hartford Public High School. He's seen some of these very same trends in action. He's going to tell us a little bit more about what kids at his school are doing when they want to go to college. We want to hear from you, 860-275-7266. If you're a parent of a college student or you're a student yourself, how much student debt did you leave college with if you got into college? Tell us your financial aid stories as well, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, we're looking at how students from low-income families finance higher education. We just heard from Marion Wang, who's an education reporter from ProPublica, who told us about a national trend in public universities providing less financial aid to the neediest students and more to those students who potentially don't need it. We're taking your calls at 860-275-7266 and your financial aid stories. Quickly, let's go to Russ in West Hartford. Hi, Russ. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I've been a public educator now for 15 years, all of it working with low-income students, and I've really seen this problem accelerate in the last 5 years or so. And a big part of the problem is that students are given aid packages up front, but those packages are subject to change, and often, most of the time, actually, the packages decline as they continue on in school. Another big problem that they have is that aid packages from year to year, the amounts aren't revealed until the middle of the summer. And I've had many students in recent years who complete a year of college, are reasonably successful there or very successful there, and then around about this time of year, receive their new aid package and find that it's just not enough time, it's not enough money for them to continue. And so that leaves them in a real bind because here they are in the middle of the summer between college years and suddenly they don't have very good options. And this has become a real problem. And it's not just with the state schools, but even some of the more well-endowed private universities as well.
Russ, before I move on to the conversation, and thank you very much for your phone call, I guess I'll just ask you the same question that I asked Marion Wang, is where do you see these students going? She reports that many are going to community colleges, which can be a very good option, but have different success rates for different students. But we've also heard stories of some kids deciding to take on more loans, going to school, and then having to drop out midstream because they just can't afford to pay for it anymore. What are you seeing, Russ?
Well, I see a lot of kids taking loans, and a lot of times it is loans that will be difficult for them to pay back or for their families to handle. Another big problem is lower-income students many times they have a more difficult time than, let's say, more affluent families at actually maneuvering through the entire FAFSA process and understanding the process and really maximizing the amount of resources that are out there and are available to them.
And this is another thing we've heard, and Russ, thank you very much, is it takes a lot of time and effort to fill out some of these forms. They're not easy to fill out, and sometimes just to get the help to fill them out, you might have to pay some other specialist couple hundred or thousands of dollars. Let's learn more from Jeff Bartlett. He's a college specialist at the College Center for Hartford Public High School. He used to work in the private sector for the last, 13, 14 years or so. You've been working with public school students. First of all, welcome to our show. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Maybe you could explain what you do as a college specialist.
Well, basically, my role is to really try to help students through the entire process, beginning with college selection on through helping them complete applications, prepare essays, and very importantly, through the financial aid process. In the 14 years now that I've been involved with this, I've probably done well over 1,000 FAFSAs with students. So I spend the time with them, and so I have a pretty good knowledge of the kinds of income that we're dealing with students in the city of Hartford and the kind of challenges that they face in attempting to get enough aid to go to school.
It was nice of you to come into our studio. One of the nice things about having someone listen in with me is I saw you vigorously nodding along with some of what we heard from Marion Wang, the ProPublica reporter, and also our first phone caller, Russ. What resonates with you so far in this conversation?
Well, I think first of all, it's the realization that there is not sufficient aid out there for low-income students, and that indeed there's been a very conscious effort on the part of public universities across the country to move money from what we call need-based aid to merit-based. And that's another way of saying that the aid is moving from poor and low-income students to more affluent students. And again, it's that issue of colleges looking more at their self-interest than they are looking at the public interest.
Have you seen this specifically at Connecticut's state university system?
Unfortunately, yes. We're seeing it there quite readily. You know, 5 or 10 years ago, as the first caller talked about, the kind of aid packages that we would see for a student would typically give that student enough money not only to attend the college but to live on campus. Mm. So a student would receive a package that would be predominantly grant money, free money, with a relatively small and manageable loan burden.
And let's just pull this apart quickly. When you say grant money, how much grant money, and what are the sources of the grant money in this more idyllic situation?
Well, in this situation, you were seeing a combination of federal grant money that would be available, as well as money from the state of Connecticut in the form of grants. And the primary area where we've seen the fall off in the last several years is in the state grant money not being available for students. So we've shifted now to a situation where a student would get enough money to go to the four-year school, live on campus, to where the state university schools, other than the University of Connecticut, will fundamentally provide enough aid for a student to be a commuter.
Okay, so not living on school, very different experience, but still an opportunity to go to school.
Right, but one that has a good deal of compromise in it in terms of the ability of the student to be successful. If we look at the city of Hartford and we take a quick look at the demographics, we have over 90% of the students who are living at or below the poverty line. Many are living in very unhealthy home environments, and to have them go to school as a commuter is not giving them the opportunity to get out of perhaps difficult family situations, difficult neighborhood situations, bit poor peer pressure, all these kinds of things that exist potentially in an inner city neighborhood don't go away if we have a student only able to commute to a college.
Very interesting what you're saying, and I assume that you and your colleagues probably have some numbers of success to back this up. But what you're essentially saying is that this idea of money to go away to school and actually spend 4 years on a college campus is more than just a nice perk. It's more than just the sort of choice that more affluent students were able to make. I made a choice to spend some time living on college campus and spend some time living at home and spend some time living in an apartment. I had that choice. What you're saying is that not being given that choice actually could hinder someone's college experience.
Oh, absolutely. A number of colleges that have special programs for students who are more at-risk students in terms of their academic profile. On campus, there are a variety of support systems available to them. If they're not living on campus, they have less access to those systems. There's more time involved in commuting back and forth. So whether it's just the ability to use the library or to go to an academic support center, those kinds of support systems aren't as readily available if you're in a commuting mode as opposed to being on campus.
And not to mention the fact that commuting mode means you've got to get there somehow, which could mean getting your own transportation or relying on a somewhat sketchy public transportation system.
Well, that's correct. And the vast majority of the students that I deal with in Hartford, they don't have a driver's license when they're in high school. They don't have enough money to afford a car, to afford the maintenance of a car, gasoline, and insurance. So it's not really practical in the vast majority of instances that I've been familiar with for a student to commute with their own car. So that means the bus. And in Hartford and surrounding areas, that doesn't give you very many options. So we see students perhaps at the University of Connecticut West Hartford campus because it's on a bus line.
We're talking today with Jeff Bartlett. He's a college specialist at Hartford Public High School. He helps high school students in the city of Hartford navigate through the world of financial aid forms, tries to get them into a college of their choice. We're talking about some of the trends that we've seen, though, less student aid at the state level, not just in Connecticut, but nationwide, going to needier students. We're going to try to find out what exactly that means and the long-term impact. We're taking your calls as well, 860-275-7266. You can also email us where we live at WNPR.org. Elizabeth is calling from West Hartford. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Elizabeth. Hi, John.
Hi there, Elizabeth. How are you?
I'm fine. You caught me unaware there. I was about to drink some water. I wanted to say a couple things. As a very long-time community college professor, I feel like we're getting a little maligned here. We have a lot of programs, a lot of pathway and articulation programs with the four-year colleges. We're the least expensive game in town. And we have a vibrant campus life. We have a brand-new campus. Much of it is brand-new. So we are providing a lot to these students, and our students are mostly financially needy students, and we've got all kinds of financial aid available. I felt when she said that our graduation rate nationally for community colleges is low, but we're forgetting about transfer rate, and we have a lot of students who come for a period of time, and then they go off to the four-year colleges. Would we like a higher graduation rate? And we're doing everything we can to do that. but we sort of get ignored for how many students come in for financial aid issues, or sometimes for ability and skill level that they still need to improve on for the four-year colleges. And then they get into these articulation pathways with the four-year schools in the state of Connecticut, and off they go. So I just hope that community colleges being commuter schools are not off the table. They're a great alternative.
Hey, Elizabeth, I'm wondering, can I ask you to hang on for just a second? Because Kathy in Manchester, I think, has a similar viewpoint. I'd love to ask you both some questions. Kathy, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yeah, well, what's on your mind? It's similar to what Elizabeth was just saying, I'll bet.
Oh, absolutely. I'm a college professor, actually, at Southern. And what we see is a lot of students through the transfer program. And I'm going to tell you, we really feel, and I'm speaking for a lot of faculty, that the community colleges are pretty darn good here in Connecticut. And we see students that are well-prepared, who have some really good skills that they've received at the college, at the community colleges. So I concur with Elizabeth in her feeling. We get a lot of transfer students. In fact, right now we're going through the transfer process, and our numbers at Southern actually increased during the transfer process. So there's a lot of movement from the first, the second year to the third year. A lot of times the students coming from a strong community college and the articulation agreements that we have with them are pretty darn good. So I think we're undercutting the community college if we think that they're not good here in Connecticut, because they really are.
Well, Kathy and Elizabeth, I'd like you to both hang on if you would, because I'd like to get a quick comment from Jeff Bartlett. I think I have a follow-up question for both of you. I'm really glad you called on this point. Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, the first thing I want to say is that I end up these days directing the vast majority of my students to community college. So we're not undercutting community college as an opportunity. I think the issue here that we have been focusing on is the fact that our four-year state university systems are falling short in providing opportunity for those students who may qualify for a more competitive environment like the University of Connecticut. They're not getting the opportunity to pursue that goal. And, you know, that's where I see the problem. Clearly, community colleges are playing an extremely important role and, in fact, are the primary route for the majority of our students. That said, we still have the issue that, unfortunately, for many of our students who live in the city of Hartford, commuting and still having to remain in that home environment is not nearly the kind of situation we would like to see for a number of those students.
Well, Elizabeth first, and then maybe Kathy, you can jump in. You hear what our expert here is saying, and I think that Marion Wang from ProPublica would kind of say the same thing back to you. We've spent plenty of time on this program talking about how great Connecticut's community college system is, but it seems as though, Elizabeth, it's almost pushed to the straining point. We're now expecting community colleges to be the place where people can learn job skills, people who maybe weren't going to go to college beforehand. They're doing an awful lot of remediation for students who probably traditionally wouldn't have had a place to go if there weren't such great community colleges. And then you've got the influx of these students who normally would go to a CSU school or to UConn, and now they can't get in, and so they're going to go to community college. It almost seems, Elizabeth, as though instead of saying the community college is aren't a good option, we're saying there's such a good option that maybe they need a lot more money, and maybe we need to think about that system differently. What do you say?
Well, I'm not going to say no to that, and anybody who works at a community college is certainly going to say we need more funds and support. But I even take issue with what he said about a more competitive environment. We prepare students for the competition of the job world. We prepare them for the competition of going on to four-year schools. The prejudice is still there, I think, that we're not the same, that we're a watered-down version of four-year colleges, and that's simply not true. Our articulation agreements with UConn and with the four-year state colleges mean that we are being looked at all the time, that our courses are the same as, or they wouldn't take them and accept them as their courses when the student transfers.
Kathy, what do you say?
Well, actually, now with the new Board of Regents and the articulation agreements, that's one of the main focuses of the Board of Regents, being from one of the state schools. We look at it as a family, as the four state schools and the 13 community colleges. UConn is out of the picture. They're not part of us. They do their own thing. We don't. Personally, as a faculty member, I would like to have them on board with us, but they're not. So we can't. I can't speak for the UConn because although I was a student there, I'm now a faculty member elsewhere. But I really think that Gray is really pulling together this articulation agreement. And I know that we talk about numbers of students at Southern all the time and trying to get the numbers of students up. And we see that the way to do that is through the streamlining, we call it, from the community colleges around us. Again, I think that the Board of Regents is doing a fantastic job about trying to pull together that process.
And Kathy, first of all, thank you very much. And also, Elizabeth, for your phone calls. And this part of the conversation, you can join us at 860-275-7266. She makes a very good point there. Jeff, UConn is not part of this system. UConn is a little different than this state university system, which, as she quite rightly says, is now under one Board of Regents heading. It didn't get off to maybe the best start, but now it seems to be going in a direction where there is a kind of a continuum here. If you start a community college, you can really get into these four state schools pretty easily.
Oh, absolutely. That opportunity exists, and there are still pathways from community colleges to the University of Connecticut that exist. I think the point is, when I look at it from my perspective, and I'm trying to get a student into the best position to be successful when they leave high school and go on to college. And if you just look at the numbers, whether Marion Wang talking about graduation rates from community college, and even if you look at graduation rates from the Connecticut State University system schools, which hover around 50% and in fact are lower for low-income students are more in the 30 to 40% range. And then you look at the University of Connecticut, which is graduating 75% of its students. So in that context, I want to see a student be put in the best position where they can be successful. And clearly, if a student has the academic capability to go to the University of Connecticut, I would much rather see them there living on campus in that environment than having to struggle through a couple of years at a community college and then transfer into whether it's University of Connecticut or one of the other state university system schools. Unfortunately, the statistics show us that if you take that path through community college, it's much more difficult and the probability is much lower that a student is going to graduate with a bachelor's degree.
There's both the statistics that you cite, which are quite clear, and they seem to follow trends across the entire country, but then there's also just the individual needs of the student. That's the person you're sitting down with, and what you're saying is, as someone who sits down with college students in Hartford, many from low-income families, you're trying to figure out what is the best place for them to get the best college education and then be the most successful in their lives.
Absolutely.
Let's go to the phones again, 860-275-7266. Larry's calling from Middlefield. Hi, Larry.
How are you, sir?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, here was my experience years ago. I got out of the military, and I had gone to community college. I had taken a lot of night school courses. It was this disparity between the university for my transcripts. I sent my transcripts to UConn and to the state schools, and it varied between 35 semester hours to 62 semester hours that they would accept for the same set of transcripts.
Mm. So, Larry,
I went to Eastern.
Yeah.
You know, because Eastern offered me 62 hours for the same set of transcripts. Then I took my ROTC and did stuff over at UConn and graduated over there.
How long ago was this, Larry, if you don't mind me asking?
No, I don't mind. You know, it was about back in 1978 when I got out of the service. I then went to, I graduated out of Eastern, where they gave me most of the credits, and then did the ROTC out of UConn.
Larry, thank you very much for that. It's a really good point that I want to bring up with our expert here, Jeff, because I think that a lot of us probably have an idea of the transfer process that goes back to, well, our time in college, Larry's time in college. And as was just explained to us, through the state university system, there is a much more streamlined way to get community college credits turned into four-year college credits these days than there used to be.
Absolutely. In fact, community colleges are set up to be able to transfer students from the community college into a four-year Connecticut State University system school, and to do so fairly easily and smoothly. That's why all these articulation agreements have been put in place, so it's made it a much smoother process than it has been historically. But I think there are still cautions, though. basically what happens, if you go to a community college with the intent of transferring to a four-year school, you want to make sure that you are in a liberal arts program and taking your general education courses. Those are the courses that are going to transfer smoothly into the four-year school. If you start at a community college, however, and you get yourself into a very specific and technical field because you didn't have the idea at that point that you were going to transfer, you may find out that when you ultimately decide that you want to transfer to the four-year school, specific courses in a specific field will not be accepted by the four-year school. They'll only take the general education requirements.
And I mentioned this to one of our callers who was calling about community colleges before. It is important to note that more and more students are going to community colleges for very specific technical reasons. Mm-hmm. They want to come out with a certificate that will get them a job within a couple of years, right? And so you're saying that if they later say, I want to go to a four-year school, those credits might not be as useful to them.
That's right.
Okay. We're talking today with Jeff Bartlett. He's a college specialist for Hartford Public High School. He worked for years in the private sector. Now he's working to try to get kids into the school of their dreams, hopefully. But there's a lot of monetary problems along the way, as we've been reporting. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. When we come back, we're going to hear from a student who's been dealing with some of these. We're also going to get to some real numbers here. Just find out what it actually takes in terms of aid or loans to get into college these days, especially if you're a low-income student. You can join us, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, do you spend your life in an office cubicle, the kind of claustrophobic, dysfunctional environment that was lampooned in movies like Office Space? Or are you in one of those newfangled Google-esque open workspaces with freedom to think and move around, maybe even play some ping pong? We're going to take a look at the changing American workplace and talk with the author of a book called Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. That's coming up on tomorrow's show. We can't wait to hear your cubicle stories. Today, we're taking some of your higher education stories, talking about a change that's been happening over the course of the last several years, less financial aid money being made available to lower-income students, more to wealthier students. What does that mean? Well, it's harder for some students to just get into school. We're talking with Jeff Bartlett, who's a college specialist at Hartford Public High School. We'll get to some of your phone calls in just a moment. We're also going to be bringing in a student who's been going to UConn Torrington. Very quickly on some numbers, and I want to get some numbers from you. When we talk about the Pell Grant that is applied for by all students, I mean, you want to get the Pell Grant. How much money are we talking here?
Now, a full Pell Grant is approximately $5,700. But that means that you're what's called a full qualifier for financial aid. In other words, when you fill out that FAFSA form, the income is so low that you have what's called an expected family contribution. That's the primary number that that the FAFSA provides to a student. It says your expected family contribution is, and in most cases in Hartford, it's zero.
It's zero.
So that means that a student is eligible to have all their expenses paid for when they go to college. So that student, that full qualifier, would get the full Pell Grant at
$5,700 a year?
A year.
$5,700 a year. So that's going to pay for community college.
Correct.
It's not going to pay to go to the University of Connecticut or to the state university schools.
No, you're looking at University of Connecticut. If a student's going to live on campus at UConn, it's going to be about $25,000 a year. At the other Connecticut State University System schools, it's about $21,000 a year. And, of course, that's the in-state rate. If you were out of state and wanted to go to UConn, you're paying well over $40,000 and well over $30,000 at the other state university system schools.
Let's talk to a student who is at UConn, wants to go to UConn stores. Ashley Kane is slated to graduate in 2017. Ashley, welcome to our show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Could you tell us your story about where you're going to school right now and what your plans are for higher education?
Well, I go to Torrington UConn. I'm a sophomore, and I plan to go to stores my junior year. I go to Torrington UConn because it was the only school I could afford at the moment when I was applying and whatnot. I wanted to originally go to Keene State College up in New Hampshire, but it was $30,000 a year, and they gave me no financial aid. So I was not saying that Torrington UConn was my second decision, but it was more affordable to go to Torrington than any other college around here.
And how important was that financial aid to you, Ashley? I mean, were you essentially going to make a big part of your decision based on how much money you were going to get?
Oh, it was a huge thing to take in consideration because I didn't really get any. There was no savings account for me, or I didn't think I'd get enough loans to go. So I needed somewhere that wasn't so expensive, like incredibly expensive. $30,000 is an extreme amount of money.
It is an extreme amount of money for anyone, but it's a really daunting amount of money when you're just trying to get yourself started and figuring out how you're going to pay back those loans. So have you taken out any loans? What can you tell us about the aid that you've actually received to help you go to school?
My freshman year, I took out a Parent Plus loan. The process of taking out that loan was horrendous. It was such a process going through the paperwork, but I'm glad I go to Torrington, UConn, because I used all my resources there, and they were great. They walked me through the whole the process of getting the Parent Plus loan and making sure if I can receive it or not due to my parents' credit. And then they gave me a Student Plus loan, which they give me every year, or student loan, excuse me, every year. So that's great for me. It's just the fact is, does your parents want to sign this Parent Plus loan? Because they have to co-sign it. I can't co-sign it because I have no credit.
Because you have no credit. And Jeff Bartlett, quickly, you were nodding your head on this too. A lot of these forms, very, very difficult to fill out. And they require parents who can actually be involved in this too. This is difficult,
right.
Jeff.
Well, this is true. And when we talk about a Parent Plus loan, the responsibility is with the parent to pay back that loan. Now, in some cases, it may be the student who's ending up paying it back, but it's the parent who's signing for it, the parent who must qualify for it. In many cases, with our students in Hartford, the parents are not going to qualify for a Parent Plus loan. So it's not an automatic that you're going to receive it just because you apply for it.
Ashley, hang tight for a second. I want to bring in a couple other callers here. Greg's in Hartford. Hi, Greg.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's up?
Hey, I was calling in because I agree with everything you hear, but I think there's one aspect that I haven't heard mentioned on the show yet about the true quality of the college experience. And so just as a quick background, I'm a graduate of Eastern. I have a daughter who goes to Southern now. I have another daughter who's looking at Keene next year. And so I've been through this rigmarole several times. But the one value that I think that the state colleges or, frankly, any four-year college offers over a community college is the fact that they're out of the house. You know, they're in the community. They're in their deep end of the pool. And the community colleges, they offer fantastic classes. They, you know, there's no doubting their quality of their education. But these half-lives that kids today have, these half-lives where they're spending half their lives at home and half their lives at school, really, in my opinion, is one of the reasons why this generation now has such difficulty launching into the regular job market. I'd almost call them helicopter college parents. It's almost the same thing.
Well, Greg, you raise a great point. Ashley, what do you think about that? You're having to live not on campus, obviously, if you're going to UConn, Torrington. Do you think that this is a factor in your college experience?
Oh, definitely. I feel like since I am home, I am missing out on the whole living on campus kind of experience. But then again, I'm getting the regional campus experience as well. I am able to work full-time and go to school full-time, which I don't think I could do if I was on campus. I feel like I'd have too many distractions.
Yeah, you're getting that experience. I certainly have taught a number of students at Central Connecticut State University who have that, and we'll call it in quotes, experience. It's a tough experience, right? Actually trying to take a full load of classes and then work a full-time job, sometimes have commitments at home. This might not be the most conducive to you getting the best possible education.
Well, it depends where you go to school. I don't agree that you're not getting the best education. I feel like you're just not focusing. Like I could be at Stores, and I could just be focusing on my education. That's true. But I kind of get the life experience of trying to juggle one thing and trying to juggle another, trying to focus on everything, because that's what you do when you get out of college, right?
I totally get what you're saying there, and you know, Jeff's nodding at me again. I think but that's really what I'm trying to say is it's a different sort of experience. It's not about the quality, Jeff. It's about the fact that you can't really focus on just going to school. It isn't a different experience.
That's right. You know, I give the caller a lot of credit. You know, to be working full time and going to college is a very tough situation to be in, and it takes a lot of juggling and it takes a lot of talent to be able to do that, and it does give you a certain kind of life experience. On the other hand, there's a lot to be said for that 4-year on-campus college experience that really allows you to become immersed in that whole college community environment, as well as to learn that independence of you are off on your own. You have to deal with issues.
It's
on
true.
Your own.
But I think to Ashley's point, it's not the real world, and the real world is a difficult place sometimes to be in. Yvette's in Plainville. Hi, Yvette. Go ahead quickly, if you would.
Hi, good morning. I think a couple of things that were not mentioned. Years ago, students going into college did not need their parents' income. I graduated college 31 years ago, and I don't ever remember having to use my parents' income. It was about my income when I completed the forms. So that was one big change. And the second thing that I haven't heard at all was that all financial aid packages are negotiable. When they give you the paperwork that tells you you're not eligible for aid, you can dispute that paperwork and explain to them why and check with alternate financial resources that the school generally has available to students that they don't always tell you about.
Yvette, two very good points. Ashley, did you have that experience? Did you negotiate at all?
Not all financial aid packages are negotiable, depending on how much your parents make and what you're doing. They can only budge so much. I've tried to appeal when I went to apply for Keene, and my parents made too much. In their eyes, they made way too much.
Well, and Jeff, this sounds right to you?
Yeah, I think, you know, certainly it's something that's going to be different by institution. Private colleges may act differently than public universities in terms of negotiation. It's something I always tell students is never be afraid to contact the financial aid office at the college. They are there to help students get enough money to be able to afford college. So don't view them as the enemy. View them as your friend. Mm. And you want to do as much as you can to create a positive relationship with people in the financial aid office because it can only help you. And yes, there are situations where if a student has some additional need, if they're really articulate and appropriate in how they approach that with the school, they may have an opportunity to get some additional money. But I would caution that to say that all financial aid packages are negotiable may be a little bit too optimistic in terms of what happens in the real world.
But negotiation is at least something that you can do and something
Absolutely.
That you can look into.
Yes.
A last word from Tanya in Wellington. Hi, Tanya. Go ahead quickly.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, okay, good. You know, I want to tell you about a financial aid nightmare that I experienced about 20 years ago. I was I had gone to a 2-year liberal arts school, private, transferred to a 4-year private school. And then because of family illness, I had to leave school altogether. And I went to work for a couple years. And then in the midst of it, I went back to school. And not long after, I run out of money and had to file financial aid. But what happened is, so I started from near the last year of my completing my bachelor's degree, the financial aid office came and said, oh, you know, the school that you went to prior claims you owe all this money, but, you know, what loans I had were on deferment, but they claimed that, I don't know what they were claiming. It was just so bizarre. But at that last year, then they start threatening me, you know, committing fraud. None of these things happened. I don't understand where that came from. It was just such a nightmare. I went and spoke with, you know, senators and different representatives and congressmen, you know, whoever, anyone. And long story short, I eventually wind up having to, a lawyer came on board. And when the lawyer came on board, she was able to turn the table to show that, you know, what they were doing was, you know, they were just overreaching, overstepping their bounds, everything.
And Tanya, I'm going to have to leave it there because we're running low on time. I know that there are a lot of these stories, difficult stories around financial aid. If you want to continue our conversation, go to WNPR.org. I want to thank Jeff Bartlett, who is a college specialist for Hartford Public High School. Thank you so much for your time today. I want to thank Ashley Kane, who is at UConn Torrington. Congratulations on a really successful career so far at UConn Torrington, Ashley, and thanks for your time today talking about higher education on Where We Live.